This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. When wildlife experts meet next week in the Emirate of Qatar, they will be considering how to control the trade in rare animals and plants. The agreement to exercise that control is called the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Most of the world's governments have signed on to it, though not always happily. It protects the kinds of species people especially want, like leopard skins, some kinds of wild ginseng, and of course, ivory. This year, those experts will start a brand new effort to protect some of the most sought-after species in the oceans. NPR's Christopher Joyce has a preview of the meeting.
CITES, as the treaty is called, protects tens of thousands of plants and animals, from orchids to elephants. But fish haven't rated very highly on the CITES list. That's about to change. CITES governments meet every 2 to 3 years, and this time they'll decide whether to list, that is, protect, several marine animals, including giant bluefin tuna and 8 species of sharks. Sue Lieberman of the Pew Environment Group says that's unprecedented.
I am actually encouraged that the governments are really willing to take on these commercial fishing industries and take on, in effect, something that relates to foods. It's not just a curio or something like that. I think it'll be very exciting.
Giant bluefin tuna are the behemoths of the tuna world. They can sell for tens of thousands of dollars each, especially in Japanese sushi markets. Mark Stevens is a tuna expert at the World Wildlife Fund.
They're spectacular animals. They're as big as a horse. They can accelerate as fast as a Porsche. If these were the equivalent land animal, they would have been listed by CITES a long time ago.
Fishing for bluefin in the Atlantic is regulated already by a special fisheries organization, but Stephen says that group repeatedly allows many more fish to be caught than biologists recommend. Now the Atlantic bluefin is down to about 10 or 15% of its historical numbers. Stephen says most people don't know that because the animal itself is essentially invisible.
Hidden under the water and thought of mostly as food rather than wildlife.
So now a lot of countries, including the U.S. and the European Union countries, want to ban international trade in bluefin tuna under CITES, which has more clout than the tuna organization. Europe's support is important since that's where experts say most of the overfishing takes place. Japan, where a lot of bluefin is consumed, opposes the ban. Besides tuna, 8 species of shark are also candidates for some level of protection. Millions of hammerheads, famously known for their bizarrely shaped head, are killed to make shark fin soup. Lieberman from the Pew Environment Group says many smaller island countries support that proposal, too.
They're making a lot of money as a spot for dive tourism, shark tourism, and they don't want all their sharks going in trade and losing the tourism edge.
On land, African elephants are the shark equivalent, a big-ticket tourist attraction. After CITES banned the ivory trade in 1989, elephant numbers rose. But elephant poaching is rising, too. Prices for ivory have skyrocketed, and shipping containers of illegal ivory are being seized all over Asia. Sam Wasser is a biologist at the University of Washington.
All of this has created a situation where we now estimate that between 8 to 10% of the existing elephants are being poached every year.
CITES governments have tried to replace the illegal market by allowing 2 legal sales of ivory since 1999. That's ivory from animals that die naturally or are culled to thin herds. Now, Tanzania and Zambia are asking CITES for a 3rd legal ivory sale. Some conservationists don't want that sale. Sam Wasser uses DNA from the poached ivory to track what part of Africa it comes from, and he says mostly Tanzania and Zambia.
These countries are denying the extent of illegal activity in their country, and the DNA essentially shows, no, this is really where the poaching is going on. You really need to do something about that.
Wasser says legal sales are not the way to do it. Others aren't so sure. Liz McClellan is a biologist with the World Wildlife Fund.
There's always going to be a market, and people will find a way of supplying it. So it's better if it's occasionally, as in the case of the last one-off sale, entirely controlled.
Nonetheless, WWF and other CITES delegations will oppose the request for another one-off ivory sale until there's better evidence that these sales either hinder or encourage poaching, which sets the stage for a wildlife battle next week on land as well as at sea. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It is calving season in Nevada's Carson Valley, and that doesn't just bring more calves, it brings bald eagles, too. Local officials took note, and they're trying to use a natural, if disturbing, part of ranch life to improve the region's tourism industry. Sarah McBride reports.
Tourists tend to skip Nevada's Carson Valley despite the mountains, fields, and cottonwood trees. As pretty as it is, Lake Tahoe and Las Vegas are nearby. So the valley had to come up with something to get people to come here.
It looks kind of ropey and gooey, and it has hay and grass in it as well.
That's Teresa Grubanich from Reno. She's looking at fresh cow placenta. She got up close with one thanks to a tour set up by Carson Valley officials. People come from as far away as Florida and Switzerland to see bald eagles. And the eagles have come to see the placenta. Actually, to snack on it. In February and early March, thousands of cows give birth to calves in this valley. Some cows eat the placenta, but others turn up their noses. Rancher James Settlemeyer says that's when the eagles swoop in.
You have to love the beauty and the magnificence of the bald eagle, but we also need to remember they are a scavenger bird.
The Carson Valley's kind of a rest stop on a bald eagle winter circuit. Mostly, eagles like fish, but placenta's too good to pass up. It's nutritious and easy pickings. Settlemeyer's family's been ranching in the area since the 1880s.
And when it's an eagle, you're happy. When it's the coyote, you're not so happy. The coyotes, if they pack together, will go after the calves.
Now his ranch is a stop on Eagles and Agriculture, a once-a-year event. It's year 9 for Eagles and Ag, as the locals call it. Ranchers throw open their gates. A fleet of tour buses rolls through, cruising for eagles. Visitors filled 4 buses this year, but there could have been more. The Bald Eagle Tour completely sold out. So did tours like Raptor, Highway and Byway, and Owl Prowl.
Now it's after her. You guys see that?
Guides like Dan Caffer give a running commentary, like during this tiff between an eagle and...
It's a red tail. Way over in the far cottonwood tree. And it's been dive-bombing her, and she's dive-bombing it.
Not all the local ranchers are on board. Many think the tours just encourage bad behavior, like people sneaking onto their property for a closer look. If visitors get between a cow and her calf, they could get hurt. Sometimes people leave gates open and cows escape. Bald eagles eat cow after birth in many parts of the country, but the Carson Valley has taken the lead in showing it off to tourists, and they love it. Kim Pittman from Reno has taken the tour 3 times.
I saw them fighting over one of those big pieces. One grabbed it and started to fly off with it, and the other bird...
You mean the afterbirth?
Yes, yes. And the other bird came after him, and he got probably about 20 feet away and dropped it.
Pittman knows that the tour has a certain...
yuck factor, you know?
Yeah. But she doesn't see it that way.
It's just really an escape. You can be totally in your stressful day, and you see that bird... or you hear it call, and it can just pop you right back into that God place.
Eagles and Ag is part of a bigger effort in the Carson Valley to preserve ranching after years of development. Leaders hope the events will get the word out about the Carson Valley's charms. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McBride.
Not long ago, carbon credits were a hot commodity. Many companies expected Congress would pass climate change legislation, so they tried to get a jump on what they assumed were inevitable cutbacks in their greenhouse gas emissions. Some invested in carbon credits to offset their pollution, but as legislation stalled, the value of those credits has dropped, in some cases dramatically. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon reports.
What do you do if you're a big company that uses lots of energy and you want to shrink your carbon footprint? You could become more fuel efficient or switch to cleaner manufacturing techniques. Or you could pay someone else to reduce their CO2 emissions for you. Someone like Tim Caldenberg. Here on his southern Iowa farm on a cloudy day, he's feeding the young steers he keeps in a pen near his farmhouse. Caldenberg is in his late 30s, and he grew up farming around here. Sure, he raises corn and soybeans, but he also raises carbon credits, although lately he's not sure why.
In the beginning, it was enough to go out for supper, maybe. Well, it's probably less than that now. I could go out for supper now as long as it was a drive-through fast food, maybe.
So here's how it works. Kaldenberg practices what's known as no-till farming on some of his land. Rather than plowing, he lets CO2 stay trapped in the soil. And then, through a bunch of complicated calculations, credits for that captured carbon are sold by the ton on a market called the Chicago Climate Exchange. Around 100 companies have joined the exchange, like Ford, Sony, and IBM, and they agree to cut their emissions by a set amount. It's basically a voluntary version of the cap-and-trade concept that many people have expected Congress to eventually make mandatory. Back in mid-2008, when there was a lot of optimism that Congress would do that, the value of those credits peaked at more than $7 a ton. Now, they're only worth a dime.
If you put all of your eggs in the Chicago Climate Exchange and you didn't decide to sell anything when you could have had the opportunity to, then I would say at this stage it's probably difficult.
Lenny Hochschild is managing director at Evolution Markets, a brokerage firm in New York. He notes that other types of carbon offsets, those bought and sold through contracts instead of on an exchange, are doing better, but they're also down about 40% since peaking last year. The global carbon market is now worth $125 billion, though much of that market is in Europe. The United States' share is still tiny, but Hochschild remains optimistic.
I don't think there's one commodity that exists out there that has grown as fast as the carbon markets.
Some regional authorities in California and the Northeast are taking steps to regulate carbon emissions on their own. But with so much uncertainty about what Congress will do, it's unclear which offsets will count in the future. Matthew Hamilton is the sustainability manager for Aspen Skiing Company, a member of the Chicago Climate Exchange.
It really is the Wild West right now. You can go out and buy a product, a renewable energy credit or a carbon credit, and it is only as good as the rules that are attached to that credit.
Hamilton says the company isn't buying carbon credits for the time being. Instead, it's taking smaller, more tangible steps to shrink its carbon footprint, like more efficient lighting, and that old standby, turning down the thermostat. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McCammon in Des Moines.